I was talking to one of my friends about the fact that I was giving a talk and just sort of approaches to take with what was quite a... I sort of feel like Ridge Yesuda gave me almost like a homework exercise. He said, look, I'd like you to give a talk, and the theme is pulling back the veil. So I was like, oh, gosh. So, yeah, I got some ideas together. But somebody said to me, oh, it's always good to start a talk with a story or an image. And it's not something I've done before when I've given talks. So I was thinking, what could I bring in? So, yeah, I'm going to start with a bit of a story and finish it later. I'm not really going to say much about it. I'll leave it to you to see how it might link with the theme. And maybe none of the content of my talk is worth talking about, but you could talk about this story at least. It's a sort of a fallback. And you'll probably all know the story. So I'll just start with that. So once upon a time, there was an emperor whose only interest in life was to dress up in fashionable clothes. He kept changing his clothes so that people could admire him. Once, two swindlers decided to take advantage of his love for fashionable clothes. They told the emperor that they were very fine tailors and could sew a lovely new suit for him. It would be so light and fine that it would seem invisible. Only those who were stupid could not see it. The emperor was very excited and ordered the new tailors to begin their work. One day, the king asked the prime minister to go and see how much work the two tailors had done. He saw the two men moving scissors in the air, but he could see no cloth. He kept quiet for fear of being called stupid and ignorant. Instead, he praised the fabric and said it was marvellous. Finally, the emperor's new clothes were ready. He could see nothing, but he too did not want to appear stupid. He admired the dress and thanked the tailors. He was asked to parade down the street for all to see the new clothes. The emperor paraded down the street, but the people could only see a naked emperor. But no one admitted it for fear of being thought stupid. They foolishly praised the invisible fabric and the colours. The emperor was very happy. So I'll just leave that story there. Okay. So pulling back the veil. I thought, as I said, it felt like a bit of a homework exercise from Ridge Yesuda. In the last main talk I did, I treated as a bit of a homework exercise. So I'm not going to kind of present the final word on pulling back the veil, but this is kind of what I've found from looking into this. What's quite a rich metaphor. So in a way, this talk's going to be really—it's going to be an exploration of this metaphor of the veil. I'm not going to pin it down and say this what it means, this is what it means, this is what it means. It's going to be a look around and see how we can use this metaphor. So for me, the connotations of the word veil, what immediately comes to mind is kind of like a translucent divide. I mean, I immediately thought the wedding veil or a veil that a woman might wear, where you can kind of see through it, but it still divides you. You know, there's a division between you and the object. Or of something that's veiled in secrecy. Halloween is said to be the time when the veil between the two worlds, this world and the other, is at its thinnest. And in Celtic culture, they talk about thin places in terms of the thin veil between the two worlds. And this can particularly apply to sacred spaces, so maybe in a shrine room or a cathedral where you feel connected with something, but there's still some sort of a division. So, you know, the veil is thin, but there's a connection. The dictionary, particular dictionary I looked in, described a veil as a thing that conceals, disguises, or obscures something. And it gave the example of something being shrouded in an eerie veil of mist. Okay, so that's just looking at the word veil, exploring that a little bit. But just to bring in the to move it towards the Buddhist Dharmic perspective. Sangharakshita, Bhante Sangharakshita, the founder of our order and movement, he said, "If spiritual or transcendental experience is a state of seeing things as they are, its opposite, mundane experience, wherein all unenlightened beings are involved, must be one of seeing them as they are not." Okay, so in dharmic terms, we could see ourselves as being in a situation where reality is obscured by a kind of veil, so that we don't see things as they really are. Yeah, so how are things as they really are? Well, according to the Dharma, they're insubstantial. They have no fixed, abiding core. They're impermanent, and they're ultimately unsatisfactory. So if we see things as they are not, we tend to see things as fixed and as permanent and as having some kind of lasting satisfaction. So what I was thinking was, okay, so we've got this veil that makes us see things in this kind of way. So how is this veil pulled back, or how is this veil removed? And the first thing that came to me was just the way that life sometimes can throw up what you might call wake-up calls or reality checks, or something happens to you. So through circumstance, the veil could be pulled or even ripped back for us, or even something cuts through the veil. And our life is disrupted in some way so that we're able or forced to see things differently, such as maybe through the experience of death. You might experience the death of somebody close to us, or we might experience illness, or the illness of somebody close to us, and we're just forced to see life differently. You know, things are going along nicely, and all of a sudden something comes through, and something's pulled back. So it's like a sudden yet temporary opening up where we can learn from, or which we can learn from, and we may be able to affect change if we pay attention to it. And I was thinking, actually, it doesn't have to be major disruptions. It could be minor inconveniences. Now, these might sound a bit silly, but I was just thinking things like losing your wallet. You know, everything's going along fine, and you lose your wallet, and all of a sudden it's like your world is like, this is rubbish, I've lost my wallet, and everything was good, and then all of a sudden everything's a bit rubbish. Or perhaps getting a flat tyre on your bike. You know, you sort of think tyres last forever, and then... And I don't know, I'm not quite sure what I was thinking when I wrote this down, but an occupied shower at the time we normally have one. So you've got a routine, and then you come down to have your usual morning shower, and someone else is in the shower. You've got this fixed expectation of reality. Okay, so you could learn something from these minor inconveniences. Or it could be a gradual growing sense that things just aren't quite right. That the way we see things and the way we do things is somehow out of line with the way things are. And when I wrote this, I thought of something that Morpheus says in The Matrix. I don't know if you're familiar with The Matrix, but there's something he says, which I'll just quote it, part of it. He says, "You know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad." So it could be a kind of a growing unease with the way you're doing things and the way you see things, and just have a sense this isn't quite right. Maybe it's what brought people to a Buddhist centre or to this weekend in the first place. And it doesn't have to be in the form of difficulty. Yeah, it could be just meeting a person with remarkable qualities. For me, it can quite often, thinking back, it was taking part in a really good study group where something just happens and something happens and you're really inspired and you don't quite know what it is. Or attending a Sangha night, or even being on a weekend like this, you just experience a different kind of reality. And just briefly, something's pulled back to just come back to this metaphor. So yeah, we're taken out of ourselves and we experience this sense of connection to something higher and something meaningful. So a few personal examples. For me, the very first thing that I remember is when I was 17 and I'd taken a book off my dad's philosophy stroke self-help section of his personal library, and I was looking at this is the actual book, The Little Zen Companion, full of little pithy, sometimes cliched sayings. There was something about it that I was looking at some sort of common sense that I'd somehow forgotten about, and it was representing itself to me. So anyway, yeah, just looking at this book planted something. Yeah, I didn't take any action for quite a long time, probably not until I was 25. And well, there's a link there because I lived quite a hedonistic life, probably between the ages of 17 and 25. And there was this growing sense of unsatisfactoriness with that kind of lifestyle. Realising that it didn't quite work. So there was a sense of getting a sense of how things were through suffering. Also the death of my mum, which happened very suddenly. Really kind of cut through something and affected me. What I've always said is quite a positive way, but I was forced to reflect on impermanence in a way that I've never had to do so before. Being asked to give this talk by Ruji Siddha, actually, I was in quite, it was just when I was starting to organise things in relation to moving to China, and I was quite up in my head, and Ruji Siddha stopped me as I was walking through, said, "Oh, we'd like to give a talk on the East Anglian men's event," and I was sort of forced to pull myself out of that and think, "Oh, I can't just think about things relating to me." It was a bit uncomfortable, but it was like, "Well, this is a good challenge. This is something to take me out of myself." So yeah, and retreat experiences. I was lucky enough to go on a 4-month retreat, 16-week retreat, where I spent 16 weeks in fantastic conditions, and there's definitely a pulling back of something that was able to reveal, you know, the subtle mental habits that I normally engaged in, not always pleasant, but also enjoying simple pleasure, more simple pleasures, not grasping for the usual things. So a stick of incense or a cup of tea or just a sharper sense of sight or sounds, and then coming back to the world and trying to do the old things that I used to enjoy and trying to extract the same sort of pleasure out of them, such as going into town and drinking coffee and eating chips and listening to music, which is fine to do, but I had this whole expectation based on how it used to be, and when that didn't happen I was a bit like disappointed and oh dear, yeah. But it was just, well, there's a way of seeing things have changed a little bit. Yeah. So, and also, an increased awareness of one's own. As we practice, we get an increased awareness of our own inner life and perhaps our changing emotional states. Yeah, noticing what we grasp at or push away, which can be painful. So I did think, this idea of pulling back the veil could work both ways, because the veil could be pulled back, but we might want to pull it back again. It doesn't always stay pulled back, so it could work two ways. And in terms of things happening to us, I did think it was worth mentioning a part of the story of the life of the Buddha, well, before he was the Buddha, when he was Siddhartha Gautama. And this is a very well-known part of his life story, which is where he's living a life of luxury, protected, as the story goes, from the difficulties of the world. There comes a point where he leaves the palace and he experiences what are said to be four sights of an old person, a sick person, a dead person, and a mendicant or holy person, holy man. And such as are the effects of these four sights in the story, that they have a really tremendous existential effect on Siddhartha, which precipitates his going forth from the life that he was leading to uncover the truth. So there's so perhaps the veil, you can see the veil pulled back for the Buddha, or as he was, Siddhartha. But there's also something about this, I think, which is important to touch into, which then is perhaps he was also having a compassionate response to the human condition, the fact that all beings experience these things. So I was thinking, just to stretch the veil metaphor onwards a bit more, the veil between self and other was pulled back, and he experienced what's called anukampa, which means to tremble with or resonate with. So resonate with the suffering of all beings. Of course, the holy man symbolised the going forth and something that he could move towards, as he did. So yeah, so far we've looked at the veil in terms of something that's pulled back or even ripped back in terms of things that happen to us, circumstances. But yeah, Buddhist doctrine makes use of the veil metaphor in a way that allows us to understand the nature of what it is that actually veils us from reality. So we're veiled from the fact that things are impermanent, insubstantial, and ultimately unsatisfactory. But what is it that veils us? And so I found a little bit about this, and I didn't know about this before I was asked to give this talk, so it really helped me in a homework exercise. So Sangharakshita writes that being a creature of desires, man is concerned not in truth but in utility. For him, things and people exist not in their own right but only as a possible or actual means to his own gratification. This is the veil of passions, known as the Klesha Varana. Okay, so this word is made up of two parts. So we've got Klesha, which here is translated as passion, sometimes translated as poison, and Avarana, which literally is translated as veil. So this is a Sanskrit word. So when we're talking about the passions, the veil of passions or poisons, which I'll refer to them as from now on, we're talking about the roots of unskillful behaviour, namely greed, hatred and delusion, or craving, aversion and ignorance. But I'll refer to them as greed, hatred and delusion, which are depicted traditionally in Buddhism at the hub of the wheel of life in the form of a cock, a snake and a pig. The cock, greed, the snake, hatred and the pig, delusion or ignorance. And the wheel of life is a symbol for what Sangharakshita calls the reactive mind, so the mind under the influence of these poisons. And the three animals, I'm not going to talk about the wheel of life, that's a whole other talk, but the animals at the centre of the wheel of life are biting each other. They're biting each other. So this represents the fact that it's a vicious circle. We grab for what we want, we push away what we don't want, and we're ignorant to the fact that we're doing it, so we just keep doing it. Or we're grabbing for what we want so much and pushing away from what we don't want so much that we're just ignorant anyway. So they kind of all feed into each other. And it's often said, actually, that that we can be kind of a certain type under the sway of one poison more than the other. So it's a question you could ask for yourself is what kind of type might I be, or even what type am I at the moment? Can I feel myself pushing away at something or grabbing something, wanting, or am I just a bit foggy and in a sort of state of ignorance? But because the poisons feed each other, you know, if we do have a particular one that's difficult for us, well, working on one are going to weaken the others. Yeah. So they're the poisons that this Klesha Varana refers to, the veil of passions or the veil of poisons. So we're so busy, stuck in these poisons that we don't even have time to see what reality is about. And just to go on to the next veil, I won't talk about this too much because I think these poisons are fertile ground for more exploration. But there is a second veil that's referred to. So Sangharakshita writes, usually We do not like to acknowledge even to ourselves that our attitude to life is often no better than a pig rooting for acorns. Motives are therefore rationalised. It gives some examples, one being, for instance, instead of admitting that we hate somebody, we say he is wicked and ought to be punished. There's other examples. I'll bring some perhaps more personal examples up in a second, but he writes that according to the Buddha, all philosophies and a great deal of religious teaching are rationalisations of desires. This is the veil of false assumptions, the Nyaya Varana, which begins with a J, the Nyaya Varana. So I see this in terms of the fact that we're acting under the influence of these three poisons, of greed, hatred and delusion, but rather than acknowledge this to ourselves, we tell ourselves stories to justify the behaviour that comes out of acting out of the poisons. So I thought a few personal ones. I remember when the whole kind of music downloading first came along and file sharing on the internet, and I used to say, oh yeah, well it's not really stealing, it's just the way that technology's going. You know, I knew there was something a bit dodgy about it, but I justified it. Or, it's not me, he really is annoying. I don't want to admit that I'm experiencing aversion. There is something objectively annoying about someone. I thought about using the idea of rebirth as a source of comfort. You know, the idea of, there is something that will carry on. If I can just satisfy this urge or take care of this problem, then everything will be okay. There is a comfortable place in life where everything can be satisfying. Actions have consequences. Except for this action I'm about to perform. So that's the veil of false assumptions or rationalisations of desires. I'm not going to dwell on that too long. But Sangharakshita writes that on the attainment of enlightenment, both veils are rent asunder. For this reason, the experience is accompanied by an exhilarating sense of release. The Buddha compares the state of mind of gaining enlightenment to that of a man who has come safe out of a dangerous jungle, or been freed from debt, or released from prison. So rent asunder, pulled back, ripped back, cut through. On enlightenment, the veils aren't there anymore. And just another dictionary definition I found of veil, which I thought was worth mentioning at this point, a sort of secondary meaning, which was a membrane that is attached to the immature fruiting body of some toadstools and ruptures in the course of development. Yeah. Okay, so it's a veil. Oh. It's another definition of a veil. A membrane that is attached to the immature fruiting body of some toadstools and ruptures in the course of development. That was an interesting link there. So yeah, we need to find a practical method then for transforming what Sangharakshita refers to as the reactive mind under the influence of the poisons, this mechanical, repetitive, unaware mind that just grabs for, just pushes away, just doesn't want to know. We need a practical way to move from the reactive mind to what Sangharakshita calls the creative mind, that is independent, responsive and aware. Much more attractive than mechanical, repetitive and unaware. So independent, responsive and aware. And I think these two states of mind are very well evoked in the opening verses of the Dhammapada, which said to be the words of the Buddha. And these are that experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So I think this evokes moving from this reactive mind under the influence of the poisons to the creative mind, this independent, responsive, aware mind. And to do this, The practice is to move from unskillful acts, which are rooted in those three poisons, to skillful acts motivated by what you can see is the opposite of the poison. So the opposite of greed, hatred and delusion is going to be generosity, or the impulse to share and give, love and compassion and understanding. So yeah, generosity, love and understanding. So that's what we're moving towards, to counteract the poisons. Whereas Bhante Sangharakshita says, it's a question of acting from what is best within us, acting from our deepest understanding and insight, our widest and most comprehensive love and compassion. So just come back to this idea of the veil between self and other. Really, what I see this as doing is we're moving from self-concern with preoccupation of ourself, which is quite painful, I think, if we think about it, to a sense of other. And I've put in brackets here, what a relief. Removing the veil between self and other. We don't have to be stuck in this preoccupation with ourselves. We can open up. We can be independent, responsive, aware, skillful. So you have to often hear of these two ideas of skillful and unskillful. So really that's what... So skillful action is an action that's motivated by generosity, love and understanding. An unskillful act, an act rooted or motivated by greed, hatred and delusion. So, so really a practical way of going about this, and it's interesting, all my talks normally always end up back on this subject, and that's practicing the five ethical precepts, okay, which I find to be a very tangible mode of skillful action that we can all undertake. So they're training principles based on this recognition that actions do have consequences, as the Dhammapada evoked. Actions do have consequences. Suffering follows unskillful action. Happiness follows skillful action. So how do we act? Well, the five precepts. We've got abstaining from harming living beings or practicing kindness. We've got abstaining from taking the not given, practicing generosity. Abstaining from sexual misconduct, stillness, practicing stillness, simplicity and contentment. Abstaining from false speech, practicing truthful communication. And abstaining from intoxicants, which lead to loss of awareness, or practicing mindfulness. So, the five precepts, they're in their negative and positive forms. Just read them. So the thing I love about the precepts is it's something we can do. We've got something tangible that we can always practice. I was given the name on ordination, Kusala Mati, which the main translation is "He whose mind is skillful." Now I don't see that as a foregone conclusion, but I think what my private preceptor saw was that I was really inspired by the path of ethics. And it was something that was good to carry on being inspired by. So this tangible undertaking that we can always practice. And actually, I remember when I first came across the five precepts, I think one of the first things that I tried to get to grips with was this thing of false speech. And I really tried to make a point of, I was working in a school at the time, and not getting involved in gossip or backbiting. And I found like a fantastic place just to practice that. This it's a practice you can always practice ethics, you can always practice the precepts. And the fact that the precepts are, really what they are is they're the natural behaviour of an enlightened being or a Buddha. So they're how a Buddha would behave naturally. They would embody them. As the Suttanipata puts it in Pingya's praises, it's one who has no inner poison drives, an enlightened being or a Buddha, no inner poison drives. So to do that, what we've got to do is we've got to act as if. We've got to act as if, and in doing so, we transform ourselves. Or as the saying sometimes goes, fake it till you make it. Tell me if that's a bit controversial. I don't think it is. You're acting as if, until you embody it yourself. Or if you want to be enlightened, act as an enlightened being. Practice the five precepts. Yeah, so looking at the, just starting with the negative precepts, the abstention. This is really what's happening here is we're moving from a disciplinary measure of abstaining to what becomes a natural expression. So the thing that I thought of first for me was stopping eating meat. And it wasn't something that just happened overnight. I got involved with the Dharma and I became more aware, and I was starting to make, you know, little decisions. Oh, well, I'll stop buying meat, but I was still sometimes having a takeaway or finishing somebody's leftovers. And then, oh, I'll stop doing that, but you know, every now and again I'd have a little bit of meat. But there came a point where it had fallen away altogether. I never really craved it, but then it just became just a natural expression. And people will say, "Oh, but you must love bacon, you know, smell it." And I was like, "Well, no, I just don't have the inclination's not there. There's no need to think about it." And that's the most tangible example I can think of, actually. Is moving away from eating meat, so practicing the first precept. Abstaining from harming living beings. People often ask me why I don't eat meat, and I say, well, it's an expression of kindness, nothing more, nothing less. I'm not even interested in being called a vegetarian. It's just an expression of kindness. So until we're truly and naturally acting from what's best within us, we will need patience. We'll remember that we are training ourselves, and there will be conflicting emotional pulls. The eating meat was an easier one for me. Moving away from hedonistic lifestyle was a bit clunkier. It involved a few wrong turns, let's say. Yeah, and these emotional pulls, they're driven by our habitual drives. So it will feel clunky when we're trying to practice the abstention. But the thing that really gets me excited is the positive precepts, you know, because I can imagine them in terms of an enlightened being behaving. Well, just to think that, okay, so an enlightened being is kind, generous, they live a still, simple, content life, they're truthful, straightforward, and they're mindful. I can kind of see something, rather than saying it's what they don't do. If I think about it in terms of what they do, I really get a sense of how an enlightened being behaves and how I can behave. And it feels like there's no ceiling on their scope for development. It's like you can just carry on developing and developing. I can't imagine any time when you couldn't be kinder. Even when you're an enlightened being and you embody kindness, you're still being kinder and kinder. So they just don't stop. They can be endlessly developed. And I think it's very telling that the first precept is the practice of kindness, with deeds of loving kindness. And I don't think it's any accident that's the case. I think we have this threefold path in Buddhism of ethics, meditation, and wisdom, which are the three main approaches to spiritual practice that we undertake. And often ethics is seen as the basic foundation for Buddhist practice. So I think if ethics is the basic foundation for Buddhist practice, we could see kindness as the basic foundation for ethical practice. Keeping in mind the opposite of the kleshas or the poisons, which are generosity, love, and understanding. So, I can see how kindness relates to that. So I just want to look now at the example of the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha, as an embodiment of enlightenment from a few accounts of his life. And what was it that came through? Well, I think it's kindness, but let's see. So at the time of his enlightenment, the texts write that his mind favoured inaction and not teaching the law, as it was profound and hard to see, hard to discover, subtle for the wise to experience. And then he had an encounter with a being from another realm, Brahma Sahampati, who urged him to teach. for the benefit of all beings. And at this point, this is a very well-known part of the Buddha's enlightenment story, is that he surveyed the world with the eye of an enlightened one and saw beings as lotuses at different stages of development, which represents the manifestation of the Buddha's compassion, where the kindness meets suffering. So this is where the enlightenment was complete, when he decided to share his experience with others. I think the example of the Buddha, the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, was primarily about who he was and not what he said. It was about who he was, not about the doctrine that was then written down, which is very important, of course, but who he was and how he met individual people in their individual situations and helped them based on their needs. The story that always comes to mind is the story of Kisagotami, whose child has died, and in her grief she goes around looking for medicine. She's not accepted that her child's died, and she's going around looking for medicine to heal her child. And she was going around, and people thought she'd completely lost her senses. One man said, "I cannot give you medicine, but I know a physician who can." And she sent him to the Buddha. And the Buddha said that, okay, well, I can help you, but what you've got to go and find is a mustard seed from a house where nobody has died. So he sends her off to find a mustard seed from a house where nobody has died. And so she goes round with her dead child, who she's just not accepting is dead, and going round the different houses. And of course she knocks on the door, and she asks for mustard seed, and she's given mustard seed. And then she says, "Oh, but did a son or daughter or a father or a mother die in your family?" And the answer was, "Oh, alas, the living are few, but the dead are many. Do not remind us of our deepest grief." And there was no house anywhere where someone beloved had not died. So she's given, as she goes round, she's eventually given this lesson where she realises the hopelessness of her situation and the selfishness almost that came out of her affection for her child, her lack of perspective without not realising the inevitability of death. And the story goes that she eventually became a follower of the Buddha. She accepts her child's death and she becomes a follower of the Buddha. So the Buddha, I think what I like about this is the Buddha didn't sort of just cruelly tell her to go away and deal with it. He didn't say everything's impermanent. No, he responded with a kindly awareness to her situation. And in the Buddha's last days, his exchanges with Ananda, his attendant of over 20 years. When the Buddha was about to pass into his Parinirvana, when the historical Buddha was on the brink of death, Ananda was said to have said, "The master is about to pass away from me, he who is so kind." So Sangharakshita points out that it's not his wisdom or understanding of philosophy or his skill in debate or his ability to work miracles. It's his outstanding quality was his kindness, as we hear from what Ananda said, "He who was so kind." Yes, and then with the Buddhist tradition, I think from the example of who the Buddha was, we do have this eventual development of the Mahayana, the greater vehicle, which is development in Buddhism with a re-emphasis on the kindness and compassion embodied by the Buddha. And then we have other ideals that come of this, such as the Bodhisattva ideal, which is a being dedicated to enlightenment for all beings. So kindness, a very kind of prominent and important feature. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I, I just think it's probably worth referring also, there's a lot of tales that relate to the Buddha's past lives before he was the Buddha, before he was Shakyamuni. And these are known as the Jataka tales. And a lot of these are tales of selfless action and kindness. There's a story of the hungry tigress where the Buddha in a previous life, he tears off his own skin to feed some starving cubs. Another one where he's a hare who builds a fire and jumps into the fire to cook himself to feed a beggar. Well, one of my favourite ones is Prince Five Weapons, who defeats a monster called Sticky Hair with fearlessness and cunning when his weapons don't work, and he teaches him to be kind to people so they can seek better rebirths. So there's these stories, the Jatakas, which evoke the kindness before he was the Buddha. Yeah, so I've just given those examples just to emphasise the importance in kindness in the practice of the precepts and how it informs ethical practice. So just going back to the precepts overall, I just a few points on my personal practice of the precepts and what I found helps. And one thing I picked up on at somebody's recommendation was when kind or generous inclinations arise, just going with them without listening to that voice that says yeah but, or waiting until the motives feel pure, like am I doing this for the right reasons. So just acting generously and kindly without holding back and not getting attached to the idea of a particular outcome or result. One thing I've learned actually living here at Padmaloka is to practice generosity with time. It can be very easy, believe it or not, somewhere here, to just just go along and shut yourself up in your room and have a nice, quiet, private life, and not really get too involved with other people. One thing I found was useful to do was just to practice generosity and just make a point of meeting people and going out to people. Or practicing stillness, simplicity, and contentment, perhaps just sitting in a chair, doing nothing, or perhaps just listening to music, not listening to music and tidying my room, or not listening to music while I'm on the computer, just sitting and listening to music. Taking personal precepts that's a sort of related to maybe one of the particular precepts. You can take a personal precept. So for me, recent ones I've done are committing to take to two periods of formal practice a day. Or just to be on the internet for only 1 hour a day, or I won't have any coffee for a month, which has just finished today. So personal precepts that you can be a bit more defined about it. And my experience of doing this is that if I stay with the practice of something, it gains momentum and it becomes easier. This thing of you just naturally take it on and it becomes easier over time. So just to remind us then, so the precepts being a practical way that we can work to counteract the effects of the three poisons of the kleshas, and a tangible way we can work to counteract the effect of the poisons by working to cultivate their opposite. So questions we could ask ourselves are, where am I with these precepts? Where do I do well? Where do I fall down? And what action could I take? And we could choose one particular precept and make a personal precept linked to it, maybe. And I even thought of this old business model of doing a SWOT analysis, this thing of strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats. Perhaps asking oneself, what are my ethical strengths that I can build on? What are the areas of weakness that I need to work on? What opportunities could I take to develop ethically? And what threats do I need to look out for that might compromise my ethical practice? So, that just came to me as maybe a particular approach we could take with the precepts. But if you're not into business models, maybe not. Yeah. So, yeah, just to sum up, really, before I conclude. So just, yeah, so we started off looking at the veil as something which prevents us from seeing the way things are, from seeing that things are impermanent, insubstantial, and ultimately unsatisfactory. We looked at the fact that life can present us with circumstances in which the veil is pulled back. So things happening to us, such as the Buddha's experience of the four sights, or Gotama as he was at the time. And then we've looked at the way that Buddhist doctrine uses the metaphor of the veil of the kleshas and the veil of false assumptions, the klesha varana and the jnaya varana, which serve to explain the nature of what it is that veils us from reality, namely the three poisons and the stories we tell ourselves to justify acting under their influence. And then moving on to the practical method of transforming ourselves, counteracting the poisons and their effects through ethical practice, namely the five precepts. And then I just moved on to highlight the fact that an enlightened being would naturally embody the precepts, which have kindness as their foundation, and which we can see through accounts of the life of the Buddha. So I'm going to conclude by concluding our story that we started. So, the emperor marched in the procession, and all who saw him in the streets and out of the windows exclaimed, "Indeed, the emperor's new suit is incomparable. What a long train he has. How well it fits him." Even though they couldn't actually see anything, but didn't dare admit it for fear of being thought stupid. At last, a little child cried out, "But the emperor is naked." "Good heavens, listen to the voice of an innocent child," said the father. And one whispered to the other what the child has said. "But he has nothing on at all," cried at last the whole people. And this made a deep impression upon the emperor, for it seemed to him that they were right. But he thought to himself, "Now I must bear up to the end." And the chamberlains walked with still greater dignity, as if they carried the train which did not exist. So we could ask ourselves, are we so different from the emperor or the people in the story?